This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, tomorrow you're going on a trip. And so tell us all about, what is this? Is this a tradition? How does it all work?
Yeah, so heading out tomorrow for Wyoming. We've got a tradition that me and some close friends have been doing now for, it's probably 15 plus years, where we go on generally a backpacking trip, but in recent years it's morphed into various other things. We've done rafting. We've done a bunch of canoe trips. So this year we're heading out to Wyoming. We're going to go backpacking in the Tetons. So one thing I've realized as I age is that each year it becomes increasingly more likely that I might not return. Right before leaving, my business partner and I had to firm up terms of our succession plan should I die or become incapacitated, and what happens with our law firm. So I wanted to get all that in place before I left. So feeling good about that. Life insurance is all up to date. So we'll see what happens.
Well, congratulations. So then what does that allow you to cliff dive or do whatever else, rock rappelling while you're out there because you feel more secure?
You know, I feel like just now putting a backpack on and hiking for a few hours is risky enough. How about you? Any travel plans this summer?
No, actually, we don't have any. Smitha is going to take our youngest boy to Paris, though.
Oh.
He is really interested in the Eiffel Tower and eating baguettes. So that's what's happening. And the rest of us are going to stay at home.
You can't accomplish those two. One of them you can accomplish elsewhere. Only in Paris. That's great.
Yeah.
That'll be fun. But you're not going on that trip? No. No one invited you?
No, not invited. And our oldest is then going to go to Miami to visit my brother-in-law. And then I get to do the teen parenting with my 14-year-old, who many of the listeners know I may need to go to therapy for some of the things that I've done to try and parent him. So
I think he may need therapy, but
Well, I'm really happy, and we're really happy to have Sarah London here today. Sarah, welcome.
Hi, so glad to be here.
How are you? Well, no, this is going to be a lot of fun, and I'm really excited to introduce you to our listeners. So Sarah, where are you right now?
I'm in Philadelphia. I'm here getting ready to kick off the 4 or 5 day AAJ conference.
That's great. Are you going to be presenting on anything while you're there?
Yes. I'm speaking on Sunday on reputation laundering and talking about a recent experience with an expert who explained to the jury why the marketing the company put out was corporate pseudo responsibility, or in other words, basically BS to get away with, you know, bad stuff. It was a really interesting experience with that expert. I think it'll be fun to share it at AAJ.
What is reputation laundering?
So the expert testified in the Juul case. Her name's Dr. Mimi Drumright, and she's a business professor. She has studied and taught for decades on corporate social responsibility. And the other side of that coin is corporate pseudo social responsibility. A lot of us know that as greenwashing, right? Or pretending like you're doing good when you're not. And a part of the case that we put on to the jury in San Francisco, we had RICO claims. And we were talking about the role that Altria played in distributing the Juul product, but not just distributing the Juul product, but also laundering Juul's reputation, using some of its expertise and mojo with convincing the public and regulators they can be trusted, that they're good corporate stewards, while meanwhile they're getting away with addicting kids. So that's how it came up in this case. And we've got some really cool visuals and slides that we used. It was the first time I'd ever put on an expert to do that kind of topic. And someone asked me to speak about it at AAJ. So there you go.
Getting a little bit ahead of myself right now, but just a little background about you, Sarah, and from a professional perspective, so that we can get into context exactly how you got to the level of being co-lead counsel in the Juul and Altria litigation and trying that case in San Francisco.
Sure. Is that calling for a narrative there, Rahul?
It absolutely is.
Objection.
Any objections overruled?
Yeah. I'll allow it.
How early do you want me to start? Fifth grade?
I mean, I've already heard the story, and fifth grade is super boring. So why don't we start in like maybe when you first decided you want to be a lawyer?
Sure. Well, that actually does start in fifth grade.
Oh.
Let's go back to fifth grade then.
No, I mean,
that's why it's so boring, I suppose.
That's why it's so boring. No, when I was in fifth grade, we were playing eraser tag every day. And if you haven't played eraser tag, listen up, folks. It's a real exciting one and definitely a great use of public school education. But it meant you would run around the room with an eraser on your head and another player would have an eraser on their head and they had to chase you. And if they caught you before the eraser fell off your head or their head, then you get to go on in the tournament. Well, the teacher that I had in fifth grade didn't like the level of play of eraser tag that was happening with the girls involved. So just kicked all the girls out of the eraser tag game. I didn't like that. And I organized our fifth grade girls and we advocated to the principal and marched out of the classroom and successfully won our way back into competitors of this eraser tag game. I look back on that and it was a really formative experience for me in the power of organizing and the importance of advocating for yourself and for others, and that I felt called to it. It just felt like something I feel like I have to do and I love doing. So it's very rewarding. And basically, I started out as an organizer professionally. After I graduated from college, I did a CORO fellowship, a fellowship program that trains leaders. And I, at that time, was certainly no leader. I was straight out of college, but I was very interested in working in social justice and learning how to be effective, holding the powerful accountable. So I became an organizer and spent several years in the Midwest organizing. I organized for Planned Parenthood. I organized for unions. I did union organizing, political organizing for several years in Missouri and Kansas, where I just learned so much more than I ever, I guess, taught anyone. Or I was a lobbyist for Planned Parenthood and an organizer. And throughout all of those experiences, I kept bumping up against the language of power. And the language of power was the law. The lawyers in the room would always use language that I felt I couldn't access and that others in my constituencies weren't able to access. And so I decided to go to law school because I wanted to learn that language of power. I wanted to be a more effective advocate, a more effective organizer at seeking social change and getting justice. And when I went to law school, I was steadfastly against practicing law. I was going to go back and be an organizer for sure until I found myself doing plaintiff's work at Leaf Grazer as a summer associate. And it just like, clicked for me. It was all the things. It was collective action. It was social justice work. And at the highest levels, extremely exciting and intellectually very challenging. So that's how I ended up becoming a lawyer that practiced law, which I did not think I was going to do.
Have you always done mass tort cases or did you start out doing something else and move on to that?
When I first started at Leaf, I worked on antitrust cases. And that's because a partner recognized me in line at the burrito shop and said, "Hey, aren't you new? I got a case for you." I didn't know the first thing about antitrust law. I didn't take that in law school, but I worked on some very big, complex antitrust cases in the first year. Actually, the first day I was at Leaf, we filed a complaint that ended up being the O'Bannon case involving NCAA athletes and their ability to get paid for their likeness and to eliminate the exploitation. That was day one, you know, of practicing law. But I found for me, I ended up moving away from antitrust work when trial work presented itself to me. I had a partner walk by my office and ask for my help with a Daubert brief in the Vioxx litigation. And this was really more of the tail end of the mass tort involving the drug Vioxx. The partner that I was working with had been very involved in the science. And so I got to jump in and learn a whole lot about the science of the drug and why it needlessly caused heart attacks and strokes. And anyway, he pulled me into the trial that we had in Louisiana on behalf of the state of Louisiana involving its payments for Vioxx. So that was really my entry into mass torts. It was really more of a adjacent case, but I was in the courtroom every minute. I ran the slides. I made the slides. I carried boxes around. I supported my partner in the case, and I learned an enormous amount. And then from there, I moved on to the Yaz litigation because it was going to trial. I got this great break in working on a trial, which then helps you get other breaks of going into trial, because if you, it's almost impossible to get experience to start. But once you get it, then you get to build on that experience and others offer you more opportunities or you seize them. So once I started working on the birth control cases and for on behalf of young women that were needlessly suffering injuries related to this birth control pill, and that was it for me. I knew that mass torts, or at least personal injury cases, were for me. And then at Leaf, we do primarily on the injury side, we do them in mass. We tend not to do many injury cases. I have done some in my career, but for the most part, that's how I ended up there. And then when my partner asked me if I wanted to go to Florida and work on tobacco cases, I said, yes. I don't know how many people turned him down before he asked me, but paying rent in San Francisco and picking up and moving to Jacksonville, Florida was not on my list of must-dos in my life, but it was an incredible opportunity. And that's where I jumped in on a case representing thousands of individual smokers or their family members in the Engle litigation and got a lot of trial experience down there. So, for the most part, I have done mass torts. I've done a few class cases, and in some cases, there's a class component and a mass tort component, depending on how you need to solve the problem and what the best levers are to push from a procedural standpoint.
Tell us about those trials in Jacksonville, Florida. How did they play out, and how did it impact your trajectory as becoming a trial lawyer?
So I was one of many lawyers that were standing on the shoulders of Stan and Susan Rosenblatt, you know, who had achieved this enormous, massive, probably undersung event, which is trying a tobacco case, a class tobacco case, against an entire industry with the help of lots of other lawyers. But they achieved this incredible result, which was a class judgment of millions of dollars that ultimately the money part got thrown out by the Florida Supreme Court. But Florida Supreme Court certified what the jury had found after 2 years of this trial and allowed individuals to come forward if they met the definition of a class member in Florida, which meant, were you addicted to nicotine and did you suffer one of the 30 or so injuries that the jury found in Engle trial was caused by cigarette smoking. If you had a client that met those descriptions, you could file a case within 2 years. Well, thousands and thousands and thousands of people came forward and filed those cases. One attorney thought it would be advantageous to file cases in federal court. The vast bulk of those cases were filed in Florida state courts. The lawyer who filed the cases in federal court, I think, quickly decided he wanted to bring in a firm with more national experience and a lot more federal court experience. And so our firm partnered with the lawyer and we brought our team in there to work on those cases, and it was complex to say the least. One of the very first threshold issues to be decided was, what are the findings that get preclusive effect in federal court? It had not yet been decided in the federal courts. And my first assignment was to read the entire Engle litigation, the whole entire transcript, 2 years of trial, and summarize it for the court to make, here's what the findings are, here's what they mean. As it turned out, the Florida courts ultimately declined to do any of that and said you never needed to do any of that. And the judge basically cast that whole thing aside, said, never mind, I don't need a summary of the trial anymore, after I'd spent a whole summer doing it. But as it turned out, it was enormously important for me to have studied these lawyers and the entirety of the trial. It was a huge and important resource for me as we went forward and tried the cases. And I became indispensable because I knew the case inside, outside, upside down, because I had studied it. And our job was to carry forward what the first jury had found and try causation and damages. But we'd have to put on liability a bit again, because we also could get punitive damages. So these were kind of strange trials. They're not, usually you would try liability, right, with causation damages. But in this instance, the jury's actually instructed of the specific findings that the prior jury had made, in addition to saying there's liability that's already decided. These are complex cases. We had thousands of them. And my partners started trying these cases, and we just lost. We lost trial after trial after trial. I think we lost maybe 6 or 7 in a row. I mean, these were not even close. I mean, we're talking about the jury being out for 30 minutes. I mean, to like go to the bathroom, pick a foreman, and we were toast, defense after defense in federal court in Jacksonville. And it was an incredible learning experience for me, and an incredible opportunity, because my partners eventually, we had so many trials and things had not been going so well. And I had gotten so much experience through that time, not really on my feet questioning witnesses, but doing the jury instructions, writing the motions, arguing the briefs, getting to know the court, the clerk, all of it. I was given opportunities to second chair and then first chair. And during that time, in that transition period, when I started picking up the files to try them myself, we began studying how to pick the jury. What we realized was that we were not doing effective voir dire. Now, to be fair to us, it's really hard to get effective voir dire in federal court. And we were seeing all these different judges that would come in and do the same thing, where they tell us that we don't need any voir dire and we'd have to fight about it. But we studied and worked very hard to learn and appreciate and understand how to gather the most information we could and effectively pick juries, and how to present the information in a more compelling way. So we sought out consultants, we engaged new visuals, we really dug in. And because we were trying very similar cases over and over and over again, it's like being a public defender in a sense, right? You sort of get to really, I mean, the law became, I knew it backwards and forwards. I understood the evidence very well. It was just how you try the case. We had this, a bit of a laboratory for how to try cases through this process. And then we started winning. And once we figured it out, we started winning, and we started winning really serious verdicts in federal court, in Jacksonville, Orlando, Fort Myers, Tampa Bay, places that are uncharacteristic. You know, these are not plaintiff friendly jurisdictions. These are federal courts with very restrictive voir dire, sometimes 12 jurors that all have to be unanimous. I mean, these were like the most impossible of trial conditions that I lived under, I have to say. I still had to wear pantyhose in like the heat of Florida. And it was, in retrospect, just such an incredible learning experience and an opportunity for me to be, I wasn't even 3 or 4 years out of law school before I had almost 12 or 13 trials under my belt, 3 of which I was lead counsel. And again, I had all these opportunities. I could argue the cases in the 11th Circuit because I knew the law and I knew the cases and the people so well. So it was an incredible opportunity. And I really thought, guys, I really thought after we reached a global settlement with the tobacco companies in those cases, I remember I walked out just dazed from the years of doing these cases and it being really all I knew. and thinking, how is this ever going to be relevant again? Have any use for all of this information and all the things I'd learned about addiction and about nicotine? And then it turned out just a few years later, they were at it again. And I felt called to step up and put that to use again.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. Can we go back to it's such a fascinating story, particularly because of the learning that you guys were able to achieve through kind of an iterative process of losing and then figuring out solutions and then figuring out how to win. Without getting into too much detail that's probably not relevant to our listeners, but can you kind of give us some of the major insights you developed through that process? And what takeaways are there for that in application to litigation generally or trials generally?
So there's a couple of things I would draw in from that experience. First would be, we worked with Alex Alvarez. I don't know if you've had him on your show, but he's a great guest. He's a terrific lawyer in Florida. And he developed this testing and focus group testing specifically for the Florida Engle trial cases, because there were so many and became such a consortium of lawyers that were doing it. And he really studied it. He did the hard work of running focus groups and doing the data. Once we studied that data and learned a lot from it, I think the big takeaway, there's two takeaways, right? One is you've got to make data-driven decisions in trial, using focus groups effectively, using jury consultants effectively, really studying the data changed our approach. It changed our practice to really understand how.
When you say the data, are you talking about juror demographics or something different?
No. So that's point two. That's a great question, because it's not about, this is the profile from a demographic standpoint of a juror that we wouldn't want on our jury. What we learned through this process is that it really came down to two questions. And that's why we were able to effectively do voir dire in federal court without ever being able to ask one question, because oftentimes the judges wouldn't even let us ask even one question, but we were able to get a questionnaire. And the two questions on the questionnaire that mattered was, are you a personal responsibility type person or a social responsibility type person? And that you can gather from what kind of jobs do you do? What are your interests? Like some of these kinds of, if you can get an attitude question, great. But a lot of times it's you looking at the kind of work that the person's drawn to or the volunteer work that they do. And then the other is, are you a leader? And if we could find people that were personal responsibility leaders, we knew who to strike, or we would know how to direct any voir dire, even minimal, that we got to getting those folks for cause. But that really was the big secret for us. And this was more than 10 years ago. You know, a lot has been written about that. And I think there's been a lot more of a common understanding, I think, among lawyers that you're doing jury deselection. But for us, it was more, what can we do with the very little information that we got? And so that was hugely beneficial to us, was just isolating for those types of information. Had nothing to do with demographics. We had four persons because we did these cases so many times, we had every kind of demographic as jury four persons drive cases for us or defense. It was just, there was no pattern to that. It really came down to those two basic profiles. Like, are you a leader type person and are you a social responsibility person or responsibility?
To develop those profiles, you're looking at the answers to other questions that would then be indicators as to how to profile the person into which bucket. You're not asking them directly, are you a personal responsibility person or social responsibility, but you're looking at the other activities and choices that they're making, answers. Is that kind of how you did it?
Yeah. And we've worked with jury consultants over the years, but there are a handful of attitudinal type questions that would even federal judges will give that aren't big red signs, but that really just
what would be some examples?
The attitude questions of something like, I think most lawsuits are frivolous, or I think most people fail to take responsibility for their actions. These kinds of questions that the data, right, coming back to the data, over testing these questions over a period of time, you can see how they correlate. So it's really trusting the data, using the questions that have been shown through the data to correlate.
You would know then before you even start the trial, based on who you had on that jury, what your chances of success were.
Yeah, absolutely right. And in fact, yeah, that was, to me, that was very illustrative for a lot of how I practice law now, and especially how I led the Juul litigation, which is to use data as power, as knowledge, and don't spend money inefficiently or go, don't chase good money after bad, right? Testing and seeing where the correlations are, the data, like, okay, that theory is not going to work. We've tested it, right? Or putting on this, the case with this theory isn't going to work. So yeah, that was a huge takeaway for me, was both following the data and knowing where to invest in a case and doing it at earlier and earlier stages, right? So you're talking about using this data. Once we've picked the jury, we generally know really how we're going to do. And that can shape how you try the case. Are you trying the case to swing for the fences? Are you trying the case to preserve a record on appeal? I mean, not to be coarse about it, but that's, you tend to feel like once you, when we've used that method and used the data, generally have a sense. Or read minds, and you don't know for sure. And we all are trial lawyers and you do the best you can. But I find that trying to even back it up further throughout the entire process of looking at what, try to build in that, those tests throughout the process, I find very helpful.
So you now have at least your method set for jury selection. And then were there evolutions or did you adapt in how you framed the case and argued it to the jury?
Yes.
How did that change over the course of those 13 trials?
Yeah, so we've simplified the case a lot. So what we were doing at the beginning, the cases we were trying, these are a 50-year conspiracy. I mean, the documents were so hot and there were so many of them. I've never had a case, lung cancer and cigarettes. It's almost like, I mean, the fact that you'd even have to explain to a jury that kind of science, it's, the level of relative risk was so high, right? But there was just so much that we had that we could do, and we weren't editing very well. And we weren't really, I think, capturing, keeping jurors' attention with using media and putting the story in a cohesive, easy to follow way. So we did make some changes in a couple of ways. One, we built a timeline as we went. And I'm still very, I love timelines, especially in a fraud case, especially in an intentional tort case, where what you know and what you do and what you say, I think that kind of thing is so important because we all need something to follow. And so building a timeline with the witnesses as we went, we did in a big board without using slides. It was just a big board that stayed in court color. It was very clear. And we made it because it was iterative and it built and the jurors could see it all the time and we didn't overcomplicate it. I still really love that technique. I love timelines. They just can't have too much on them. Just the right thing. Exactly what you need to argue to show intent and show fraud. And you can do it for, you know, negligence too. But what you knew and when you knew it and what you did. So I like really, we more effectively use timelines. We also focused a lot more on video clips, shorter video clips. Again, now that's, I think, pretty standard, but more than 10 years ago, people were still, we weren't quite in the Twitter phase. It needs to be so short, but we shortened and tightened video a lot. And we also really streamlined graphics. I mean, we went from the kind of PowerPoints that we all remember and roll our eyes at to bringing the case alive on the few points that really mattered. So those were the visual aspects of it, the timelines, simplifying it. The other thing that we did, and I still use to this day, is how you sequence the witnesses. So a big thing that we learned at the beginning was when we were putting together our trial order of witnesses, a lot of times we started with the plaintiff, or we didn't care so much if like the plaintiff, an expert talking about the damages kind of fit somewhere in the beginning. We just didn't have a whole lot of like, we weren't very intentional about every single, the order of the witnesses. What happened, we found, is that the defense was just hijacking our case over and over and over again in the beginning, right? So if our expert, we called early an expert or a back witness that was talking about the individual who was injured, then the defense's whole case would come at the very beginning because that was what they wanted to talk about, right? They always wanted to just talk about the individual person and whatever complicating factors go on for them and muddy up the case. And so we just stopped letting them have that opportunity. And we would only call liability experts, or in our case, they were punitive damages experts, by people that would come in and teach the scheme, teach the liability, walk the jury through all the lies and how that caused this massive fraud and all of that stuff. There was no way the defense could cross-examine on our individual person, on our victim. And by structuring our case so that we pushed their main defense to the latest part of our trial, it really changed the vibe, right? Because the jury could stay focused. We kept control of what we wanted the jury to focus on. And that was a big shift for us to see that result. So I'd say those are the key main things. You know, we also got some bad advice in studying, right? So we went to a jury consultant, and you know, I'm not going to name names, but this was like one of these people who makes a lot of money writing a lot of books to tell us all what to do. And we went to the guru hall, and we all were like seated in this big room. They sat at the end of the table to like give us their wisdom without having really learned anything about our case or not doing it at all. And they told us that, well, they looked at me and said, well, you have bangs. That might be what's going on. Like, you can't be covering your face. And I was like, we flew all the way across the country.
That was my first thought too, but I didn't want to say anything.
I know. Well, see, you see, I don't have bangs anymore. So maybe that is it. But unhelpful stuff out there for sure. And some sexist stuff for sure that we encountered. But overall, those would be my big takeaways. I'll say one other thing, and that is I had to be myself, right? So my partners that tried the cases early, I learned how they did it, and that worked for them. But that's not my style. I had to develop my own rapport with the jurors, and I had to bring my own style to it. And when I let myself do that, so in the opposite of like, don't have bangs or some stupid thing, the real answer was be your authentic self. And I got so much good feedback from jurors in these trials. I connected with them. I just was me. I didn't try to put on a show. I was always I tried to shoot very narrowly about here's what we're going to prove and not try to oversell it and try to over deliver and really just play to my strengths and not try to be somebody that is I'm not and put on somebody else's case. Things that help me explain and understand and digest information, that's the way that I leaned into, as opposed to try to use too many other people's tools and tricks. And that doesn't mean I didn't borrow. I always borrow from cool things that I learned from other people, but really just trusted myself and spoke from the heart, you know, when I close and that kind of thing.
This is so fascinating because if a trial lawyer gets a good result, oftentimes people ask like, what worked and what didn't work? And we can talk about what we think worked, but only through trying the same case over and over again do you actually get some actual data points to work off of to say, I can actually drill down and see what wasn't working and what tweaks were made, and then how that actually affected a change in the outcome on cases. This is pretty cool. You should write a book about all the changes on this because not a lot of people get that opportunity.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So in the remaining time we have, I'm curious about the Juul litigation. I think probably a lot of our listeners have heard about that, but don't really know what's going on exactly and where to turn to, and maybe if they see a case or how to issue spot where there is a case, or what's the status of it all. So can you bring us up to speed on that?
Sure. So the Jewel case in the beginning of, let's see, 2018, the newspaper started covering a lot of stories about kids using Jewel. And that was just the tip of the iceberg. A lot of parents, including lawyer parents, were seeing their kids just getting totally hooked on this thing.
Can I ask a really dumb question?
Yeah.
Is Juul a brand name?
Yes. So Juul is an e-cigarette. It's an electronic cigarette. It's a vape.
Right. But that's a specific brand of vaping is Juul.
Yes. And Juul was the first of its kind. So before Juul came along, the electronic cigarettes out there were like those big plumes. They were like these big machines, you know, that people would like.
Like bong hits?
They looked like bongs. Yeah, they kind of looked like bongs. Not that I would know what that is, but they looked like that. They were big machines with like big clouds of smoke, and they were very, or they looked like cigarettes. They actually like manufactured them to look like cigarettes and taste like cigarettes. And none of them were very good at addicting people because they were really harsh. When you tried to take them in, their chemistry made it hard for the nicotine to get to the brain very fast. So they never really caught on as a substitute for cigarettes because of that. And the guys who made Juul said, hey, we've got an idea. We're going to make something that is going to hit like a cigarette. And they did. They developed a product that looked like a USB drive that the chemistry of it allowed for the inhalation to be smooth and to get really deep hit in the lungs and fast to the brain, which is exactly what makes cigarettes so addictive. So they figured that out, but then they added, of course, flavors on top of it and then marketed it like the coolest, like hot new iPhone on social media channels that like I never saw because I was too old. When I was 35, I was way too old to see a Juul ad. It swept the nation. And then Philip Morris came in and got a piece of the action and paid $13 billion for a stake in the company and then amped up its distribution nationwide, got it into like every bodega, every street corner, and helped Juul clean up its reputation, which by then looked like a bunch of youth drug dealers. So it was the hugest, most popular e-cigarette for a long time. It created a nationwide vaping epidemic that plagued schools. So Rahul represents some of the largest school districts in the country that were jumped into the litigation to on a public nuisance theory. There were tens of thousands of individuals and families who brought cases because their kids were addicted. But then there's all this other crap that's in the vape, right? So you've got kids that are inhaling chemicals over and over and over again. You see other issues, right? You've got kids with lung damage. You've got cardiovascular injuries and brain seizures from just nicotine overdose. So you've got injured kids, you've got school districts that where it's a huge nuisance, and then we have consumers who have been lied to and believe that this is a thing that's going to help them quit smoking, or somehow they don't, Juul doesn't disclose what's in it. So all the cases were consolidated in all the federal cases in front of Judge Orrick in the Northern District of California. And in California, they went to the JCCP in LA, and there were a couple of judges over time that took over that case. And Judge Orrick appointed four of us as co-leads in the MDL, myself, Dina Sharp, Ellen Relkin, and Dean Kawamoto, and a steering committee of about 20 firms. And we led the case with the strategy of we are flying in the force field. We are going to try these cases. We're going to work up cases on all the different kinds of cases at the same time. We are going to work the common issues. So we're not getting siloed, like the personal injury cases are here and the school district cases are here. We had this strategy of bringing everybody along at the same time so that we could try really any case, the first one that was ready when the judge was ready. So as of now, we reached a global settlement on the eve of trial in last fall with Juul, and those settlement programs right now are closed. So there aren't more cases being accepted into the settlement. And if somebody had a new case, there's going to be some onerous type of orders, discovery orders, if you come forward now. Juul itself has, I don't want to say it's cleaned up its act, but the flavors that caused this epidemic, the marketing, all of that are no longer there. And a lot of the kids, unfortunately, have moved to other vape products. Not that Juul isn't still a problem, it certainly is, but there are other bad actors out there too. So at this point in time, you know, we're not accepting new individual Juul cases, but I'm very much on the lookout for other companies that want to repeat the same get-rich-quick scheme that preys on kids in the nicotine space, in the cannabis space. I think that, unfortunately, this problem is not going away, and big tobacco just keeps going. So I wish I could say, what will I ever do ever again that will take on any relevance based on what I've done? But sadly, I think we're going to keep fighting this fight for a long time.
I think you have pretty good job security, sadly.
I hate that. Yeah.
Well, this has been really fascinating. We really appreciate your joining us for this. We'd love to have you back because we could probably go for another hour and not cover all the ground I'm interested in hearing about.
I really appreciate you your interest and look forward to chatting with you again anytime.
Awesome, Sarah. And then through this, we got to get the next time we'll talk about why you hate visors and vests so much.
No.
I think it's self-evident.
Oh, come on. Come on.
Well, I don't know about vests, the visor thing. It's a middle-aged male thing.
Oh, my gosh. Well, then I've been a middle-aged male since I was like 13, I think. So, unbelievable. Well, anyways.
Like, what's the point of a vest? You know, just put on like the full sleeve. You're cold, put on something with some sleeves.
Next time.
Next time.
We'll cover that.
Next time.
We'll bone up. We got to be prepared for this.
Enjoy your trip.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us, Sarah.
Okay. Bye, guys.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.